Today on Jay Sekulow Live, a federal judge delays the move by DOJ to drop the Flynn case, and an overview of my dad's Supreme Court oral argument yesterday on behalf of President Trump. We'll talk about it today on Jay Sekulow Live.
Live from Washington, D.C., Jay Sekulow Live.
Supporters of Michael Flynn thought that it would be just a mere formality for Judge Emmett Sullivan to sign off on the DOJ's decision to drop the Flynn case and then vacate his guilty pleas. But Judge Sullivan has got other ideas. He is now inviting outside groups and outside input, inviting people to file what are called amicus curiae briefs, or so-called friend of the court briefs, from anyone who would like to weigh in on what the DOJ decided to do and how Judge Sullivan should respond.
Phone lines are open for your questions right now. Call 1-800-684-3110.
Former Watergate-era prosecutors, including Richard Benveniste, they have filed a notice with Judge Sullivan that they intend to file an amicus brief arguing that Sullivan still has the authority to sentence Flynn to jail.
And now, your host, Jordan Sekulow.
So a bizarre move in the Michael Flynn saga, where it appeared that Michael Flynn would finally be getting the justice he deserved after being set up by the FBI in what the Department of Justice called an illegitimate investigation to begin with. We're starting to learn about the unmasking by Obama administration officials of Mike Flynn, DNI, the acting DNI, Richard Grinnell. Rick Grinnell has actually declassified those names. Yep. He has not turned them over yet to the Senate. Lindsey Graham's asking for that, but that could be done very soon, and it could be released to the public. We also, though, now have this judge's new order, and this is bizarre. Now, if you know us at the ACLJ, we file amicus briefs all the time. We don't file them typically ever. I don't think, have we ever filed
a criminal case that went to the Supreme Court on a constitutional issue.
So on a side issue.
But the removal of a plea that had been entered into by a defendant.
Yeah, so no. So here what we have
is
a situation where the judge in D.C., is going to allow for amicus briefs to be filed and oral arguments to be presented about why the Department of Justice decision was wrong. Now, we've explained to you on this broadcast that it wasn't done for Michael Flynn until the judge accepted the DOJ's a new brief that they filed, withdrawing the pleas. And then he could have asked for more information from DOJ, a presentation from DOJ. It wouldn't have been that bizarre.
No.
Because he does have to accept it. So no one needs to tell this judge, Dad, that he has the power to reject or not the DOJ decision.
No, this is all originated by a group that wrote, "We investigated the Watergate scandal, and we believe Trump should be impeached." This was 17 former Watergate special prosecutors. I suspect that what this is going to be, they're not only going to be going after General Flynn, but I suspect they're also going to be trying to go after the Attorney General, who took the appropriate action by confessing, having the Justice Department remove the charge. Motion, basically agreeing to the motion to withdraw the plea because the nature of what took place there was completely unconstitutional as to General Flynn, unprecedented in under criminal law what was going on.
In most cases where a prosecution, whether it's a local, federal, if they were to submit this to a federal the trial court judge,
district court.
Are accepted.
Yeah, but you don't have amicus
briefs from outside parties.
No,
to criticize and make this more political, which is exactly what this judge has
done.
Yeah,
I think Judge Sullivan, with due respect to the court, is making a tremendous mistake.
In his past decisions, he's never allowed this.
I think he has a standing order prohibiting it.
But I guess this has changed everything. So we will walk you through this. I think Andy Economo is going to be joining us too to kind of walk through what this could mean. I think ultimately, General Flynn, the charges get dropped. But I do too.
I just don't like this environment it's creating.
A partisan
that's requiring
criminal law.
That the president's going to have to, the General Flynn's going to have to go through a process again publicly in a courtroom where you're going to have a bunch of lawyers that have nothing to do with the case or the Department of Justice saying, "Oh, we don't think you should allow General Flynn to withdraw his plea, even though the prosecutor said you should."
Think about that for a moment. We already see politicized constitutional law, civil cases.
Yeah.
But the politicization of criminal cases is pretty scary stuff.
Unreal, actually.
I mean, it kind of reminds me of the IRS targeting, things like that, but even worse in this situation. We'll take your calls, 1-800-684-3110. Remember, sitting next to me, he was representing the president yesterday by phone from where, close to where you are right now.
Look at it.
At the U.S. Supreme Court. We'll play sound from that
there
and explain it today as well on the broadcast. We'll be right back.
The challenges facing Americans are substantial. At a time when our values, our freedoms, our constitutional rights are under attack, it's more important than ever to stand with the American Center for Law and Justice. For decades now, the ACLJ has been on the front lines, protecting your freedoms, defending your rights, in courts, in Congress, and in the public arena. And we have an exceptional track record of success. But here's the bottom line. We could not do our work without your support. We remain committed to protecting your religious and constitutional freedoms. That remains our top priority, especially now during these challenging times. The American Center for Law and Justice is on your side. If you're already a member, thank you. And if you're not, well, this is the perfect time to stand with us at aclj.org, where you can learn more about our life-changing work. Become a member today, aclj.org. Only when a society can agree that the most vulnerable and voiceless deserve to be protected is there any hope for that culture to survive. And that's exactly what you are saying when you stand with the American Center for Law and Justice to defend the right to life. We've created a free, powerful publication offering a panoramic view of the ACLJ's battle for the unborn. It's called Mission Life. It will show you how you are personally impacting the pro-life battle through your support. And the publication includes a look at all major ACLJ pro-life cases, how we're fighting for the rights of pro-life activists, the ramifications of Roe v. Wade 40 years later, Planned Parenthood's role in the abortion industry, and what Obamacare means to the pro-life movement. Discover the many ways your membership with the ACLJ is empowering the right to life. Request your free copy of Mission Life today online at aclj.org/gift.
So we're going over the Michael Flynn matter. Why? Well, because the judge of the case has decided he's going to have amicus briefs in a criminal case, federal criminal case, for those who want to criticize the Department of Justice. Now, I guess it's an interesting point that does this open it up then for the ACLJ to file an amicus brief agreeing that, with the Department of Justice?
I'm going to read. Let's ask Andy about this. I'm not saying we're going to do that, by the way.
No, but it opens a lot of doors.
Because I want to see what the order actually, how the order defines. But hey, Andy, have you ever, I mean, in all the criminal cases you tried as an assistant U.S. attorney and as an acting U.S. attorney, had you ever had this happen?
This has never happened before in the 45 years I've practiced law, and most of which I've been a federal and state prosecutor. It is the judge's responsibility upon motion of the government to dismiss a case, to simply say the case is dismissed and the case is over. I have never heard a free-for-all in a criminal case where it's come one, come all, let me hear what you got to say. If you want to put in your oar in the water, I'll listen to you. This is something that is unprecedented. I thought I'd heard it all, but Judge Sullivan has added something new to my store of knowledge.
I was going to read just from his order. It's a short order. It's called a minute order. He wrote, given the current posture of this case, the court anticipates that individuals and organizations will seek leave of the court to file amicus curiae briefs pursuant to local civil rule 7-0. There is no analogous rule in the local criminal rules, but the local civil rules govern all proceedings in the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia. I mean, it's very bizarre here. So there's nothing in the criminal rules. So he's taking civil rules.
If you had a question of constitutional law in a trial,
you would appeal that kind of separate issue, right?
I think when it went to appeal, you could have, but I can't imagine before the trial court, allowing amicus participation in the trial proceeding. Now, Andy, what's also interesting to me here, the way this is worded, I mean, technically the American Center for Law and Justice could file a brief.
Why not? I mean, we have a right to be heard. If the 25 or 17 old Democratic prosecutors who are going to be revived from the Nixon era, including Ben Venisti and Lacovara and all those who wrote the editorial for the Washington Post favoring the impeachment of President Trump, put their two cents in. Why shouldn't the ACLJ be heard on this? Why shouldn't anybody on the street who wants
imagine,
to say,
could you imagine, you know,
though, I have
if
an
we
opinion
filed?
I'd like to be heard, too.
Yeah, I can't wonder what the reaction would be. I wonder if we get oral argument time.
Yeah, well, that's the other additional part,
I guess it'll
Andy.
Be by
it's
phone.
Not just a brief that you get to file. You actually get to go and present before the judge or give an oral argument at a district court level criminal case, federal court. So, I mean, I just wanted, from a U.S. attorney standpoint, you've never seen this before.
Well, Andy said he didn't see it before, but here's why. Another judge in the D.C. Circuit, Amy Berman Jackson, observed, while there may be individuals with an interest in this matter, a criminal proceeding is not a free-for-all. The court will enter a scheduling order governing submission of any amicus curiae briefs. What's so ironic about this, to me, Andy, is you're not supposed to have a free-for-all in a criminal proceeding, but that's exactly what this invites.
Well, Judge Sullivan cited that in his minute order, Jay. He cited Judge Berman Jackson's statement that a criminal case is not a free-for-all. And furthermore, he is appealing to the local civil rules of the district court when this is a criminal proceeding. I don't know where he's coming from or what got into him. I have no idea.
All right, we are taking your phone calls. This 1-800-684-3110. That's 1-800-684-3110. Let's go to Jim in California on line one. Jim, welcome to Jay Sekulow Live. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Hey, Jim.
Question is, aren't judges required basically to base their decisions on Constitution and the rule of law and not everybody else's opinion?
I mean, it depends on the kind of situation. Listen, we file amicus briefs all the time. They're not district court level, so trial court level criminal cases. There may be issues.
And listen, there's been a big constitutional issue at a trial court.
That arises out of it.
Yeah, we will, and the court invites amicus briefs, you'll do it. But in a criminal case, during the trial, on a plea withdrawal, no sense.
So, I mean, that's the thing, Jim. This is not like interpreting the Constitution. This is giving the opportunity for partisan actors who already have shown their partisanship by writing an op-ed saying they wanted the president to be impeached. They supported that. They're the Watergate prosecutors. I mean, I'll go to Than Bennett, Washington, D.C. I mean, Than, it's just like the worst of Washington right here on display.
Yeah.
You see the Department of Justice do the right thing under Bill Barr. It's why the ACLJ, I think, should look into filing a brief here because he's opened the door to everybody. Why not present orally? Hey, you got the Supreme Court. Why not go on behalf of Bill Barr and say Bill Barr did the right thing? That's who's actually at stake here, right?
Well, the real question is Bill Barr's actions.
I mean, that's the thing. Here we have a separate branch of government inviting commentary on another branch of government's decision-making process.
Yeah, Jordan, actually, that's the part of it that bothers me the most. This is the branch of government that is the least directly accountable to the voters, and there's a reason that it's set up this way. I mean, these judges are nominated by the head of the executive branch, who is directly accountable to the voters, and then confirmed by the legislative branch, who is directly selected by the voters. Jordan, why would we allow a judge who does not have that accountability to make prosecutorial decisions? That is the entire reason that the structure was set up that way, and it becomes pretty frightening when they're able to do it. Jordan, I think many here in Washington, D.C. are asking the question, when is enough enough? I mean, the FBI D.C. field office decides to close the case, and Peter Strzok and Jim Comey and President Obama overturn it. The Department of Justice, who has the prosecutorial decision, decides enough is enough. We're not going to pursue it. And now a federal judge is going to reopen it. I think Everybody wants to know when enough is enough, Jordan.
You know, I think, you know, Andy, I'm sitting here thinking about it, and it's kind of incredulous what he's doing here. Now, He probably has the authority to do. I don't even think he does have the authority to do. I think it's out of the ordinary. So maybe you take a writ of mandamus to the Court of Appeals here. But if the judge were to open it up, which he has, to amicus participation, and we were going to file institutionally as the ACLJ, not as the president's lawyers, but as the American Center for Law and Justice, we have on our team lawyers with significant U.S. attorney experience, including Andy, who was a senior head of the criminal division in Georgia, and I was with the Department of the Treasury. I mean, we could bring quite a list, Andy, of lawyers that have had previous experience, including previous Department of Justice lawyers. I'm thinking of mutual friends of yours and mine.
Yes. Jay, in February, I argued this identical case before the Georgia Court of Appeals. A witness in a criminal case in which he was not a party, he was just a witness in a criminal case, wanted to intervene in the criminal case because he said his reputation had been impugned by testimony that had been given in that criminal case. And the Superior Court judge said, no way. A criminal case is an action between the government or the state and a defendant. It's not for anybody walking down the street who feels, oh, I was impugned or someone did something wrong and my reputation is at stake, like an expert witness or something of that nature. So I have just argued and I'm waiting for a decision from the Georgia Court of Appeals on this same issue. Can you intervene either as an amicus or as a party in a criminal case if you're not the state or you're not the government? The answer is no, you cannot.
Bernard on Facebook wrote, I feel like this weaponizes the courts to be able to harass those you disagree with. I mean, I think that's the decision here. Now, another person wrote it, Heather on Facebook, can Judge Sullivan overrule Attorney Joe Barr? Here's the interesting part, Harry, is that Judge Sullivan doesn't have to accept the DOJ position. It would be bizarre. DOJ would appeal it. They would likely ultimately win.
Yes.
But he doesn't have to accept it. He doesn't have to get a bunch of people telling him that he's right on that to make that decision. Now, it would be a decision he'd be highly criticized for. I think it would bring up a whole issues of separation of powers. Then it brings up a lot of constitutional issues. But he doesn't have to get a bunch of people supporting him on the record that what he can do as a judge.
Right, Andy?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. We're not a judge. It's not the position of a judge to take a poll as to what it is that he should do. He is a judge. It is his responsibility to look at the law. The law says upon motion of the government, a criminal prosecution shall be ended before a trial has commenced. There was no trial in this case. His job is to simply say, okay, prosecutor, so ordered, so granted, end of story. It's not his position otherwise to opine on an executive decision. As Jordan pointed out, there are three branches of government, or was it Than? One of them, both of them were correct. The least accountable to the public is the judiciary. You're not a prosecutor.
It's interesting here. Cindy Powell, in her motion opposing this, says this court has consistently, on 24 previous occasions, summarily refused to permit any third party to inject themselves or their views into this case. And now when there's about to be a removal of the plea, this is the time you want to enter in? Oh, well, let's hear from everybody? Now, does the court have the authority to do it? We're going to find out. I think a lower court, district court here, would be reversed by the D.C. Circuit. But again, that's delaying all of this. So I'm going to give it some real. I'll talk to Andy after the program. And we could put together a list of prosecutors from, you know, a lot of experience.
All right, folks.
Probably hundreds of years worth of experience.
Yeah, we'll be taking your phone calls, 1-800-684-3110, your comments on Facebook and Periscope. We come back, we'll do some overview of that Supreme Court case yesterday, too. These are these first Supreme Court cases ever not being held in front of the judges, but in front of the judges by phone, so not in person. But they were also broadcast live, so we've got the sound for you all ready to play. We'll talk about that, representing the President of the United States before the Supreme Court in what is a very different, I will say, a kind of feel. 1-800-684-3110. Go to ACLJ.org.
Only when a society can agree that the most vulnerable and voiceless deserve to be protected is there any hope for that culture to survive. And that's exactly what you are saying when you stand with the American Center for Law and Justice to defend the right to life. We've created a free, powerful publication offering a panoramic view of the ACLJ's battle for the unborn. It's called Mission Life. It will show you how you are personally impacting the pro-life battle through your support. And the publication includes a look at all major ACLJ pro-life cases, how we're fighting for the rights of pro-life activists, the ramifications of Roe v. Wade 40 years later, Planned Parenthood's role in the abortion industry, and what Obamacare means to the pro-life movement. Discover the many ways your membership with the ACLJ is empowering the right to life. Request your free copy of Mission Life today online at aclj.org/gift. The challenges facing Americans are substantial. At a time when our values, our freedoms, our constitutional rights are under attack, it's more important than ever to stand with the American Center for Law and Justice. For decades now, the ACLJ has been on the front lines, protecting your freedoms, defending your rights, in courts, in Congress, and in the public arena. And we have an exceptional track record of success. But here's the bottom line. We could not do our work without your support. We remain committed to protecting your religious and constitutional freedoms. That remains our top priority, especially now during these challenging times. The American Center for Law and Justice is on your side. If you're already a member, thank you. And if you're not, well, this is the perfect time to stand with us at ACLJ.org, where you can learn more about our life-changing work. Become a member today, ACLJ.org.
All right, welcome back to Jay Sekulow Live. This is Jordan Sekulow. We're going to get to your calls on Michael Flynn. Probably we start our second half hour because we did want to update you, all of you who have followed my dad's career, followed his work at the ACLJ in behalf in front of the United States Supreme Court. Unique opportunity. This is outside of his work for the ACLJ, but representing, as you know, as he has, President Trump and private capacity, his private capacity, my dad's private capacity before the U.S. Supreme Court. And so he represented the president. I did it in the impeachment trial now before the U.S. Supreme Court. That was yesterday. And these are these oral arguments that are happening by phone.
Last one today.
The last one is today.
Yeah,
and then the court will go into – the court will start writing opinions.
Yeah, the opinions will be written. They're going to actually vote on this probably today.
This won't be as long as a wait because this came later.
Yeah, I think we'll still get the decisions at the end of June, I think.
It's pretty early. Pretty quick for
sure. And it's interesting because – Jordan's going to talk in a minute. I'm going to go over to show you how we did this.
Yeah, we haven't released the footage of this yet, but actually we were able to film my dad doing the oral argument, so you can actually see kind of what this looked like. But here we go. I mean, so he's going to walk over there. We'll show you what it was like yesterday. And again, this is so he had a setup. I don't know. Are we going over there yet? I think you've got your mic is on too there.
Yeah, I think it is. I don't know if it's lit over here. Can they see? So the shot's a little dark.
Yeah.
But this is how we had it set up. And the reason I did it this way was we had this, Aaron Hodges had a carpenter build this podium. It's very similar to the Supreme Court podium. And then I had, because I needed a focal point, because that's the hard part here. There was a table. We had a table that was right next to us, just like at the Supreme Court. And when she banged before she said, oye, 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 do we have the beginning of the case? Let's play the beginning of the case. I'll walk you through this.
The Chief Justice and the Associate Justices of the Supreme Court of the United States. Oh, yay, oh, yay, oh, yay. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of the United States, are admonished to give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
And Jordan and I stood up during that process because out of respect for the institution of the court. There was a case before ours, which was a related case, my colleagues handled. Obviously, we were sitting here taking notes and working on it. And then it came time for me to do the argument. Now, because I wanted to get into the frame of mind of an argument, some people have said they did it. They've done it sitting down. They've done it in casual clothes. I wore a blue suit, a white shirt, a red tie. I don't know if we have a picture. Do we have a picture? Yeah. Blue shirt, blue suit, white shirt, red tie, just like I was at the Supreme Court in the United States. I have a podium that is like almost identical to what's at the Supreme Court. We had it set up with a microphone so that I could project, and then it was all hardwired into hard lines, and then I had what are called in-ears that were in my ear so I could see it. And then for our purposes, we videoed it because it's kind of a historic moment. You never would have that again. Of course, it was already released, so it was already simultaneously out there. But what that allowed me to do also was to concentrate on focal points when justices asked questions. And so it sounded a little bit more, I think it sounded more realistic than most of the other ones. And they were all fine.
Yeah, now what is unique, I'm going to play this for people, is that I don't think I've ever seen in all the times I've gone to see your cases and other cases, Justice Thomas ask a question. It has happened before.
I've had it a couple times,
yeah,
very rare.
Yeah, I mean, but in these cases, he's been extremely active.
Yeah, and he's been great. His questions on both sides, tough questions,
he's
good
had
questions.
Intro, first round questions, second round questions, follow up questions. So for people who have not heard from Justice Thomas a lot, let's play it. This was his first question to my dad yesterday at the oral argument. This is Justice Clarence Thomas, who is not very active usually in asking questions in the oral arguments in person, but in these phone arguments, as many have said, they've kind of found his voice.
Yep.
Here he is, Justice Thomas.
I'm interested in whether or not you can point us to some express language at the founding or during the ratification process that provides for this immunity.
Well, there's a couple. There was a colloquy between Vice President, ultimately Vice President Adams, and Senator Ellsworth, where they talked about process against the president, and they took the position that any process against the president would be constitutionally problematic. Thomas Jefferson, of course, wrote in the letters he had regarding subpoenas that were issued in the Byrd trial that allowing local magistrates to bander about a sitting president from north to south and east to west would interfere with the president's responsibilities. And as this court just in the previous argument just stated, the burdensome nature of this is categorical. It's not, you can't just look at the one subpoena. It is the potential for 2,300 DAs, or just 1% of them, 23 DAs issuing process against the president. But the concern over interference from our founding with the president's responsibilities was discussed, and that's why in the Constitution there's process to deal with it.
So if you're watching on our Facebook feeds or social media feeds on TV, this is where we did it. We had American flags in the background. We just try to create the right environment. I have other colleagues that I know stood up at podiums as well on this. And what was interesting was by having our video cameras in this place, which we have many of, and knowing that I was being videoed in that sense, what it allowed me to do, whether we'll ever show that video or not will be another story. We may when it's all done. But what it allowed me to do was to really focus. And by not having to have a speakerphone here, but having the microphone, which served the same effect as a speakerphone. And a huge thank you to our technical team. And the Supreme Court was great and their technology people in getting this done. To pull that off, you had, I'm trying to think how many lawyers were, there were eight lawyers involved in yesterday's hearings because our cases, we had three cases. It went for 3 hours and 40 minutes for these cases. So you can imagine we were on our feet for a long, long time.
And usually this would be, even if you had two cases like this back to back, I mean, it would be 1 hour each case tight.
It would not go
over 1 minute usually.
So normally when you split your time, it's like 20 minutes for you and 10 for the Solicitor General. And it was like on the first round, I think I was almost 30. Then he went about 25. And then the other side went about collectively 45. And then I came back up again.
Yeah, because they didn't have anybody for the splitting their time. So they got the same time you got, which was instead of one round, basically by the time they let every justice ask a couple of questions.
Yes.
And there's some time, obviously Chief Justice Roberts had some kind of time in his head about how long they got, but it wasn't exact, it wasn't specific.
Is there another bite?
We have an image up now.
Oh, so we can put an image, oh yeah, there's the image yesterday, so you see it lit up for people yesterday, that was like what it was like. So
that was about as real, that looked like it was during the closing actually, because I could see by the papers I had out, we had a table right next to that, and I was able, just like in the Supreme Court, had the petition appendix there, had, if there were documents I knew I was going to need, Jordan had them there that were available so that I could just use them. But it went great. The greatest challenge is you're not being able to read body language.
No, and you don't see the interactions, of course. It's just different. I mean, you're not in a courtroom. The Supreme Court is grand. The Supreme Court has a special feeling to it, a special look. It's unlike any other courts in our country. The time limits, like I was talking about.
Strict.
The strict time limits. The lights that you have that say if you want to you have to reserve your own time usually in the Supreme Court.
Yeah, here they did it.
Here
for you.
You got rebuttal time time.
We'll
That's
do this.
All unique.
Yeah, we'll go back to next half hour. We'll do some more on General Flynn, but we'll do another segment on the case. So those that may be joining in the afternoon or later, get the second half of the program.
Yeah,
we'll do it. We'll do some more when we come back.
All right, we come back. We'll talk more with you about Michael Flynn. We'll get Than in the discussion too, more and the economy as well. 1-800-684-3110 to join us. People are holding on the phones. They want to talk about Michael Flynn. We're going to get to that right away after this just a very short break on Jay Sekulow Live. And, of course, follow all that we're up to at ACLJ.org on our social media pages as well. That's, again, ACLJ.org, Facebook, Twitter. We'll be right back on Jay Sekulow Live.
For decades now, the ACLJ has been on the front lines, protecting your freedoms, defending your rights, in courts, in Congress, and in the public arena. The American Center for Law and Justice is on your side. If you're already a member, thank you. And if you're not, well, this is the perfect time to stand with us at ACLJ.org, where you can learn more about our life-changing work. Become a member today, ACLJ.org.
Talking about freedom. Talking about
Live from Washington, D.C., Jay Sekulow Live. And now, your host, Jordan Sekulow.
All right, welcome back to Jay Sekulow Live. This is Jordan Sekulow. So we're going to get back, if you're listening to us, some of that Supreme Court discussion, but we want to go right back to what's happened with Michael Flynn. Let's reset the stage because we didn't talk about it in the last segment, and we've got a full bank of phone calls about this. So the judge of the case, Judge Emmett Sullivan, he's a federal court judge, district court judge in D.C., overseeing the Michael Flynn case, issued what's called a minute order. It's very short, but it does have a lot of citations in it, some interesting ones to say the least. I'll read the beginning. Given the current posture of this case, this is the Michael Flynn case, the court anticipates that individuals and organizations will seek leave of the court to file amicus curiae briefs pursuant to Local Rule 7-0. There is no analogous rule in the local criminal rules, but the local civil rules govern all proceedings of the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia. He talks about what an amicus brief is because it doesn't represent the parties. This opens it up to, even at the district court level, and not on a sub-issue, really. I mean, I guess it's a... The issue is that is really it's not about whether Michael Flynn is guilty or not. The issue is the Department of Justice making the right decision, but it's opening up to groups like us. But that's not who the focus is. The focus is clearly on these Watergate prosecutors who have already supported the impeachment of President Trump. They've already notified the court, Dad, that they want to file. So we know what this is all about. This will be not just an attack on Michael Flynn yet again. But it allows more partisan politics in our federal courts, unfortunately, in a criminal matter. But it's going to be an attack on the Department of Justice and Bill Barr.
No, I think that's exactly right. And Andy, you've got the most experience as a U.S. attorney among our group here. It seems like to me that's what this is.
Yes, it clearly is an attack on the prosecutorial discretion of the executive branch of government through the Attorney General, Bill Barr, and the right of the government to make prosecutorial decisions as to who to prosecute and who not to prosecute. And it is not within the province of the judiciary to then, on a motion to withdraw a guilty plea, to take a poll, which is what he's doing. Come one, come all, and let's hear from you and see what you got to say, and then I'll make a decision whether I'm going to sentence this man or not. That is not the function of a U.S. district judge. This is the first time I have ever heard of a judge injecting himself into a criminal case in this matter without simply saying the government doesn't want to prosecute, the government has the right to start a prosecution, the government has a right to cease a prosecution.
All right, folks, we're taking your phone calls, 1-800-684-3110. Let's go to Roland in Illinois on line 5. Roland, thanks for holding on. You're on the air.
Okay, like you guys, I got two quick questions. First of all, can Barr or Flynn claim incompetent or ineffective counsel?
Michael Flynn, that was already part of his, right? I mean, that's part of his case. He switched counsels, Dad.
Right.
So he has already.
I don't know if he's argued ineffective assistance of counsel.
Has he had to do that yet?
They were not effective. I will tell you that.
Yeah.
But that's not what's happened. Sidney Powell's done a phenomenal job.
That's not this case.
Yeah, but.
Right, I mean that's not what this is about, though.
No, this is about the plea itself. Now that, but that plea was entered into under the previous counsel.
Yep.
So I mean, the caller raises a good point. Could an ineffective assistance of counsel claim be raised in something like this? And maybe I'm talking. I'm getting emails as we're on the phone right now on the air. I'm getting emails, Andy, from former U.S. attorneys and assistant U.S. attorneys, some from the tax division. People want to write on this.
Well, I mean, you know, you can raise a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel pretty much any time. You can do it in a habeas corpus proceeding after the plea and sentence has been entered by the court. But that's not the issue here, Jay. The issue here is simply, can the government cease a prosecution, and does the court have the right to interject itself in and say no?
All right, folks, again, we got a lot of phone calls to take. We're going to take those calls. We're going to focus on taking more of your calls in the next segment of the broadcast. And again, this is opening the door. Though it's the liberals saying, yay, it opens the door to people like us. If they get time, by the way, to present orally in front of this judge, even if that's by phone, shouldn't we? Shouldn't those supporting the decision by the Department of Justice? Why? I mean, there's nothing in this minute order that prevents those who agree with the Department of Justice from filing. It's not just like one-sided. That would be even more kind of unique, I'd say. We'll be right back.
challenges facing Americans are substantial. At a time when our values, our freedoms, our constitutional rights are under attack, it's more important than ever to stand with the American Center for Law and Justice. For decades now, the ACLJ has been on the front lines, protecting your freedoms, defending your rights, in courts, in Congress, and in the public arena. And we have an exceptional track record of success. But here's the bottom line. We could not do our work without your support. We remain committed to protecting your religious and constitutional freedoms. That remains our top priority, especially now during these challenging times. The American Center for Law and Justice is on your side. If you're already a member, thank you. And if you're not, well, this is the perfect time to stand with us at ACLJ.org, where you can learn more about our life-changing work. Become a member today, ACLJ.org. Only when a society can agree that the most vulnerable and voiceless deserve to be protected is there any hope for that culture to survive. And that's exactly what you are saying when you stand with the American Center for Law and Justice to defend the right to life. We've created a free, powerful publication offering a panoramic view of the ACLJ's battle for the unborn. It's called Mission Life. It will show you how you are personally impacting the pro-life battle through your support. And the publication includes a look at all major ACLJ pro-life cases, how we're fighting for the rights of pro-life activists, the ramifications of Roe v. Wade 40 years later, Planned Parenthood's role in the abortion industry, and what Obamacare means to the pro-life movement. Discover the many ways your membership with the ACLJ is empowering the right to life. Request your free copy of Mission Life today online at aclj.org/gift.
Yeah, while these Supreme Court cases, by phone, I will say this, are longer than normal Supreme Court cases. They're kind of like
by three times.
They remind me of the campaign finance case of most, maybe, where they had
a 4 years
extended.
Yeah,
but they did that. But they told everybody before this is exactly. Still, it was exactly how long you're going to have, this was. You knew you got 2 minutes at the beginning.
I think they did.
We'll get back to. We're going to do more of this in the next segment. But you knew you got your 2 minute opening and like a 2 minute closing.
Yeah, I think that.
A rebuttal.
I actually think the court did a great job by being able to pull this off. The clerk's office did a great job. The justices were prepared. It's different. It's a completely different feel. We'll talk about that in the next segment. But you know what? They got it done, and that means even in the time of a pandemic, the institutions of the United States can work forward, which is good.
Yep. All right. Let's go right back to the phones. Talk about Michael Flynn in this matter. Pam in Michigan. Online too. Pam, thanks for holding on. You're on the air.
Hi. In your opinion, why are the political pundits okay with the term soft coup, but dance around the word treason? I've followed this quite a bit, and it sure looks like treason to me. In your opinion, is it treason or not?
Treason is the death penalty.
That's why.
I want you to think about that for a moment, Pam. These acts are heinous, what was going on, and they feel like they're treasonous. I would say, to reach the level of treason, which is punishable by death constitutionally, I mean, what do you think?
Pretty serious. You have to give aid and comfort to the enemy of the United States. I don't think there's treacherous acts that have been committed here. I think you've got, in the case of Judge Sullivan, a district judge who is injecting himself far beyond what the parameters of the Constitution intended for an Article III judge to have in a criminal prosecution.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, and I think here, really, the important part there is you're aiding and abetting a foreign enemy. It's not just breaking the law or violating the Constitution or violating criminal law. It's aiding and abetting. But it's treacherous and it's treasonous because it goes against the ideas of our founding
exactly.
Is that you don't use your political perch as president, which President Obama loved doing and got away with. Let's just say, I mean, so far has. And it was interesting in the Flynn matter, because it's not involving the judge, but hey, if we get our oral argument time, why not? Because by that time, I think we're going to know everyone that unmasked
maybe
Michael Flynn. Yeah, maybe. And everyone about everything about Obama being involved. We didn't think, even those of us who, again, did not give a lot of credit to President Obama, but didn't give him the credit that he was pretty good at shifting things around so he never had his hands on fingerprints on things.
Yeah.
This is what he did.
Yeah, apparently
people are on the record under oath saying they learned about Michael Flynn's investigation by Peter Strzok from President Obama. That he was instructing DOJ attorneys about it.
I was going to ask Stan about that one, because that was the newest revelation in this unbelievable saga that continues to roll on. What's your thoughts on that one?
All you have to read is President Obama's people's transcripts. I mean, you don't have to read the people that were opposed to President Obama. If you read Sally Yates' transcript, if you read Mary McCord's transcript, if you read James Clapper's transcript, they all tell the same story. Yeah, we knew there was no case there, and we proceeded it anyway. And why did we proceed with it anyway? It's because that's what President Obama wanted. They all don't say it in the same words, Jay, but I mean, I think Sally Yates' testimony is maybe the most constructive, is that, you know, she got hesitant on this because why? Well, because the president was in the room and she needed to protect the president. What she just didn't know at that moment, she did know later, even though she didn't reveal it, is that everybody else in the room already knew that President Obama knew. So, Jay, you only have to go to President Obama's own people and their words to confirm that he knew.
And we know that Andy is a big fan of Sally Yates. Andy?
Oh, yeah, Sally Yates. She claims that she was dumbfounded and flabbergasted and had no idea what was going on. Don't believe that for a minute.
Brenda called in from California on line 3. Brenda, welcome to Jay
Sekulow. Before Brenda goes, I expected Andy was going to say, which you did not, always protect the king, which is what you...
Which is exactly what they were doing, Jay. You know, it's the fundamental tenet of the game of chess. No matter what you do, protect your king.
All right.
Brenda in California, you're on the air. Thanks for holding on, Brenda.
Sure. Yeah, I might be way off base, but I really believe with all of everything that I've seen and even heard from even Obama's mouth that he's the head, he's the reason why, and he got to the judge. I really think somehow, because it still seems like a power controlling issue with him.
It's interesting, Brenda, because he had the phone call with his staff that they say call a leak, but obviously it was pre-done. It was not a real leak. No one's complained about it being released. There was a released, basically, statement by President Obama, highly political, very unusual to hear from the former president, especially the previous president, about current things going on. Usually they take a step back. They do bigger kind of issues and things like that. So he's highly critical of the decision by Attorney General Barr. And he told his staff that audio is released within days, and this is after the Department of Justice filed this last week, within a couple of days of that audio being out, Judge Sullivan now has opened the door to those who agree with President Obama, who has no power anymore under our constitutional system, to write briefs and present oral arguments before the judge about why President Obama's position on Michael Flynn is right. And Attorney General Barr, who's the Attorney General confirmed by the U.S. Senate, chosen by the president, but is the Attorney General of the United States in charge of the entire Department of Justice and FBI, is wrong.
But it sounds like to me that this is, Andy, a setup of General Barr, an attempted shot at General Barr, and the president.
That's exactly what it is. I mean, the Attorney General of the United States has made a prosecutorial decision via the U.S. Attorney in D.C. I read the motion to concur in the allowing of the vacating of the plea. Ultimately, it is the decision of the president as the unitary executive to direct his attorney general in the interest of justice to do or not to do something, okay? So when Judge Sullivan does what he's doing, it is indirectly, if not directly, an attack upon the attorney general and the unitary executive, the president.
I think that's exactly right. Let me tell you what we're going to do coming up. In the last segment of the broadcast, we're going to recast we're going to play a lot of the sound from the Supreme Court case. I'm going to go over to the area where I did it, so we'll do that in the last segment. But while we have Andy now, let's try to go through these calls.
Yep, let's go to Mary Ellen, Illinois. Hey, Mary Ellen, welcome to Jay Sekulow Live.
Oh, hello. Thank you for taking my call. Knowing what Judge Sullivan's history was, and he didn't surprise me with the left going crazy, but my question to you all is, can he keep doing these, requesting these amicus briefs and then pushing the court dates, you know, way beyond November's election?
So, Andy, I mean, how long can this thing extend out?
That judge can do anything he wants for as long as he wants to do it, unless the D.C. Circuit tells him otherwise, because that is the power of a U.S. district judge. He doesn't have to rule. He can sit on it. He can ask for amicus briefs. He can ask for oral argument. He can reject it. He can just, as I said earlier, he can sit on it and not do anything. He can do anything he wants. That's why you have this life tenure, and this is the peril of that and the unaccountability of district judges to anybody.
And I'm not sure he's the final word even on this amicus situation, because I think the D.C. Circuit could intervene upon appropriate motions being filed. So I'm going to check into that as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's because you could crash this party for them. I mean, the way he's opened the door to this, the order that he wrote, and we don't have a submission timeline yet. That hasn't come. Like Andy said, this extends the process like almost
months.
Yeah, because it's not just the written.
Not
briefs.
Fair to General Flynn.
He's also saying oral arguments.
Not fair to General Flynn. Let's grab the last two calls here.
Yep. Let's go to Jay in South Carolina on line four. Hey, Jay, welcome to the show.
Hey, yeah, thank you. Hey, question for Andy. Andy, let me ask you to put yourself in Sidney Powell's shoes, and I think she's done a great job.
She has.
Why wouldn't you seek a writ of mandamus?
You may well seek. I mean, I'll go first. You may well seek a writ of mandamus. That's what I was just talking about. You may go to the D.C. Circuit with a writ of mandamus here, Andy. That may be a very viable option.
Well, I think it is. I mean, mandamus, of course, says this is the problem with mandamus. Mandamus simply is an order from one tribunal to an inferior tribunal that says, do your job, rule, do what you have to do, but rule. So that mandamus may ultimately not be appropriate when the judge is saying, I'm taking this under consideration. It's not that I'm not doing what I'm supposed to do. I'm just taking my time to do it in a reflective fashion. So we'd have to look into mandamus, but that is an option.
I'm sure
although
Sidney Powell
I think
is. I can't imagine she's not. Yeah,
she is.
All right, let's take another call. Claudette in Maryland, line five. Claudette, quickly, you're on the air.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. In the unlikely event that President Trump is not reelected, which I pray that he is, and this current investigation is not concluded with sentences meted out to the guilty parties, can the new Democrat administration be legally allowed to throw out this current investigation? And my other question is, what steps can Republicans take to prevent...
Your second one. We don't have time for your second one, but we will answer the first one, because it's a really good question. It will depend on what the final disposition of this case is. If the plea is revoked and the case goes away, could they reopen it? Probably nothing preventing it. That would be such a political action, though, that the political retribution there would be incredible. So I think that would raise other constitutional issues.
All right, folks. We will continue to take, again, we're going to get into this Supreme Court, what that was like yesterday. And, of course, if you're watching on Facebook and Periscope, you're going to see some of that, what it was like as well. We come back. Always go to ACLJ.org as well.
Only when a society can agree that the most vulnerable and voiceless deserve to be protected is there any hope for that culture to survive. And that's exactly what you are saying when you stand with the American Center for Law and Justice to defend the right to life. We've created a free, powerful publication offering a panoramic view of the ACLJ's battle for the unborn. It's called Mission Life. It will show you how you are personally impacting the pro-life battle through your support. And the publication includes a look at all major ACLJ pro-life cases, how we're fighting for the rights of pro-life activists, the ramifications of Roe v. Wade 40 years later, Planned Parenthood's role in the abortion industry, and what Obamacare means to the pro-life movement. Discover the many ways your membership with the ACLJ is empowering the right to life. Request your free copy of Mission Life today online at aclj.org/gift. The challenges facing Americans are substantial. At a time when our values, our freedoms, our constitutional rights are under attack, it's more important than ever to stand with the American Center for Law and Justice. For decades now, the ACLJ has been on the front lines, protecting your freedoms, defending your rights, in courts, in Congress, and in the public arena. And we have an exceptional track record of success. But here's the bottom line. We could not do our work without your support. We remain committed to protecting your religious and constitutional freedoms. That remains our top priority, especially now during these challenging times. The American Center for Law and Justice is on your side. If you're already a member, thank you. And if you're not, well, this is the perfect time to stand with us at aclj.org, where you can learn more about our life-changing work. Become a member today, aclj.org.
watching on Facebook and Periscope, but even if you're not today, I encourage you to go check it out. It's the newest addition to our studio.
Yes,
it's a podium. Now the lighting.
No, oh, it has lighting now.
Yes, you're fully lit. Oh, so, you're fully lit.
Yeah, it's bright.
Actually. You can just do the so this is radio where show I,
this
by
was,
podium.
I'm going to get a plaque put on this because it was, certainly was historic, a Supreme Court oral argument during a pandemic via phone. But we had a really great setup here. And this case involved, we had three cases involving the president. The first two were combined in one argument. My colleague Patrick Strawbridge did that one as well as the Deputy Solicitor General of the United States, Jeff Wall. And then I did the next case with the Solicitor General, Noel Francisco. And the good thing about doing the second one, I was able to kind of argue, and you know this, Jordan, all of them, because they kept asking about, well, then the previous case, and it was the exact same subpoena. So Congress issued a subpoena for records of the president, including for the records of the president's kids. I mean, it was really absurd. And then the Manhattan DA, 6 months later, copies the subpoena and issues it to the president's accountants for his personal records, including financial statements, conditions of financial worth, and, of course, his tax returns. None of which is required by the Constitution, by the way. So those were the arguments. And I would say of all the arguments that have taken place over the 10 that they selected, the ones that we were involved in sounded more like a Supreme Court case because the justices did kind of interject more.
Yeah, I think even in the Little Sister of the Poor case, which is an abortion case, which usually gets the court pretty riled up.
Yeah.
It was like, it's the second time they've heard that case. They were all kind of saying, even those on the left, why is this not handled now? Why are we hearing this again? Why have you not given the compromise? The court, and especially under Chief Justice Roberts, is always looking for how do we limit this? How do we limit our power? Limiting came up a lot. We're limiting.
Let's see if we have anything from
a good exchange that we do have. It's with Justice Kagan. So she's coming from the left of the court.
She's smart.
And former Dean of Harvard Law. She asked again. This idea, and there were people on Twitter who really didn't understand this. Now, a lot of people on Twitter, you don't really want to read their comments on understanding Supreme Court law.
You're right.
But they don't understand this idea that the president, as an individual,
is a branch of government.
And to people, that sounded shocking. But to Justice Kagan, she worked for president before. She understood what you were saying.
Yep.
By 56.
Why isn't the way to deal with these two things, that the president is special, but that the president is like an ordinary citizen in that he's subject to law, is to say the president can make these usual objections that a subpoena recipient can make about harassment or about burden, and the court, in reviewing those, of course, should take seriously the president's objections and treat those with a certain kind of sensitivity and respect due to somebody who is a branch of government. Why isn't that the right way to do it?
For two reasons. First, and I think the case here is the perfect example. Here, the district attorney copied verbatim the House Oversight Committee and Ways and Means Committee subpoena verbatim. So, and we were just discussing in the previous case the nature of that burden. For counsel, the president hiring counsel, for each time he could be subpoenaed as a witness, or in this particular case as a target, would raise a serious impact on the president's Article 2 functions. So we think a categorical approach, and it's very specific here, state process as to the president, targeting the president's documents in a criminal proceeding should be prohibited.
I had an interesting discussion with Justice Breyer. I don't know if we have any of those.
We do.
Where I get into some of the things that, I don't know which one we have, but let's go ahead and listen to it.
We do, with exactly what we're going through right now. Why were we doing a Supreme Court case by phone from the radio studio? It was the because of the COVID-19.
Can I set this up a little bit? I was initially, you got to figure out, is it the right thing to do? But when I came in here, into the studio, and got behind the podium, and realized I was arguing to the highest court in the land, the most prestigious court in the world, whether right, left, or center of the justices, the most prestigious court in the world, and we're doing it by phone, that this was a unique time in American history.
Yeah, it was even too dangerous to have a cleared courtroom that would release the live audio.
Right.
That bring them together because all of them are above the age, basically, except for a couple, would be too dangerous. So, again, this is that exchange with Justice Breyer, who also comes from the left side of the court, bite number 8.
To require the president to have to respond to each and every state district attorney that would like
to... No, he would hire you and he'd hire a lawyer to list what the burdens are. That wouldn't take a lot of time. And then he wouldn't be burdened because you'd go in and say what the burdens are. And if you're right, you win that case. They are saying the other side, there are no burdens here.
Well,
you say there are. So send it back and let them figure out what they are.
I think doing that establishes the problem with an analysis of a case-by-case analysis. For instance, in this very case, in this subpoena found on page 118A and 19 of the petition appendix, there's a list of documents that are extensive. You would have to meet with the President of the United States. I mean, could you imagine just for a moment, Justice Breyer, that I, and you said he, let's assume the President were to hire me, that I'm going to call the President of the United States today and say, I know you're handling a pandemic right now for the United States, but I need to spend a couple of 2 to 3 hours with you going over a subpoena of documents that are wanted by here, the New York County District Attorney. I know you're busy, but you, can you carve me out 2 hours?
Yeah, so that was what I tried to do there, was to establish the reality of the world that the president lives in and the world that the court is now functioning in. I do want to say again a huge thank you to the court personnel for pulling this all off. Putting this all together. This was not an easy task, and they did a fantastic, really fantastic job. Do we have time for one more of those, Jordan?
Let's see. Here we go. Do we have another exchange, guys? Will's going to choose one for everybody. I think we got time for one, probably one more.
Oh, yeah. This is how the case starts.
Yep. Here you go.
We'll hear argument next in case 19-635, Donald Trump versus Cyrus Vance. Mr. Sekulow?
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. No county district attorney in our nation's history has issued criminal process against the sitting president of the United States, and for good reason. The Constitution does not allow it. Temporary presidential immunity is constitutionally required by Article 2, and accordingly, the Supremacy Clause defeats any authority the DA has under state law as to the president. The Second Circuit is wrong and should be reversed. If not reversed, the decision weaponizes 2,300 local DAs. An overwhelming number of them are elected to office and are thereby accountable to their local constituencies. The decision would allow any DA to harass, distract, and interfere with the sitting president. It subjects the president to local prejudice that can influence prosecutorial decisions and to state grand juries who can then be utilized to issue compulsory criminal process in the form of subpoenas targeting the president. This is not mere speculation. It is precisely what has taken place in this case and with the subpoena we challenge. In the argument just concluded, we asserted that the subpoenas did not serve a legitimate legislative purpose, and they were burdensome. Yet the DA copied almost verbatim the House Oversight Committee subpoena with an additional 13 words which seek the president's tax returns. How revealing. The exact same language utilized by two congressional committees would subsequently be copied by the New York County District Attorney, covering the exact same documents and sent to the exact same recipients, yet purportedly for two completely different reasons.
So that gives you kind of a taste of the first minute and a half. It's all available on, I think we have it posted. C-SPAN has it posted. But this is where it took place. And my grandchildren got to be here. A couple of our team members were here. That was it. I wanted my grandchildren to be at the argument in Washington. Obviously, that was not to be. And we did the best, I think, replication of the experience by doing it right here at this very podium.
For decades now, the ACLJ has been on the front lines, protecting your freedoms, defending your rights in courts, in Congress, and in the public arena. The American Center for Law and Justice is on your side. If you're already a member, thank you. And if you're not, well, this is the perfect time to stand with us at ACLJ.org, where you can learn more about our life-changing work. Become a member today, ACLJ.org.